So if they see on the back spine it says Gothic or it says Western or it says science fiction, okay, they know where to put it. If it doesn't say anything, they don't know where to put it. And they either send it back or they stick it in a lot of mainstream stuff, which may have no relationship to what the reader and the would-be reader is looking for. So there's a sort of compulsory classification that it does continue, at least in the paperback field, and it's frankly a vital thing for paperback publishers to do this.
By the way, I think that some of these magazines I've seen, they should, instead of writing Gothic or something, they should work out little symbols for the illiterate ones.
I have a horror story in that connection. I wrote a mystery novel 2 years ago, which is horrible enough in itself, but I make a mistake of titling it American Gothic. In paperback, I have seen this not ever on the mystery shelf. It's either in the Gothic section or under American history.
I wonder if any of you would comment on the significance of the emergence of non-newsstand paying fantasy markets, like Whispers. I've kind of six of them now that they have any awards. Do you think this will have any significant effect on things?
I do. I think that efforts like Whispers are extremely healthy and. Yes, I think they're excellent. You're sort of pumping energy into the field, and as Mr. Block was saying, it's a market where you know what's being bought, so that you can write that sort of stuff for that sort of a market. I think they're marvelous. I wish Godspeed to anybody who gets into that.
It's a great and necessary encouragement for young writers, and I'm all for it.
I think that indicates that there is a demand for the short story, which is not being supplied by professional publications. The best horror stories of the year and the best fantasy stories of the year are being driven to draw on sources like that because there just aren't enough good fantasy or horror short stories available in professional publications. So this is a very excellent development.
I've just been told that the gentleman over in the corner there has been trying to get my eye and he's failed. Is there a question to that? I don't know, somebody over, Mr. Black, there's somebody over here.
There must have been an illusion or something. Yeah.
Two brief questions. Mr. Wolheim had success publishing the horror stories, which was originally a British publication. Both Fontana and Penn put out a series of horror stories, which you can get mail order through Britain or up in Canada if you happen to be buying books there. But I've never seen any of those on the American market. Wondered why they weren't republished in this country. And also what the possibility would be of republishing some of the out-of-print pulps. We had that with some of the Shadows and Doc Savage, etc. Why not some of the short stories that appeared in Weird Tales or even issues of Weird Tales reprinted as paperbacks?
Well, it's a possibility. I know that in England, the book of collected ghost or horror stories, such as you mentioned the Pan collection and others, have apparently had a steady and loyal audience. This has evidently not been the case in the United States. Perhaps there's a market which I will say my competitors are overlooked. I found by more or less accident. It exists. There is a market here for that. Why didn't anybody in paperbacks pick up the Pan book for American editions? The answer to that is that I don't know. I think thinking back on my own experience as an editor, I would say that an editor who comes up with this idea has got to persuade the publisher. The publishers of paperback companies are not usually book people. They are accountants. They are high-end executives. They will look at the book and say, well, why, if this is so good, that none of our competitors published it? And they tend to draw back. Why do we do that? Look, we can put out a Gothic novel or a Western for the same price and be sure that it will sell. We don't know that it will sell. And these men are working in dollars and cents and hard facts, and they draw back. They draw back from experiments of that sort. They have to.
The gentleman who asked, why hasn't anyone in this country published either the Pan or the Big Old collection of horror stories. Well, a few years back, Berkeley published about three of the Pan horror stories, and Bagel Books, which is a subsidiary of Valentine, I think, has been doing the Fontana series for about 5 years now. So they've also been doing Robert Aikman's series of the best ghost stories as well. So they have been reprinted in this country. Up to about a few years ago, I was finding them on the newsstands all the time. But I don't think that Bagel was, or Berkeley has been reprinting them since then.
I think that that and the occult explosion, as they call it, is usually the fascination with the devils and strange wonders and eerie powers and so on coincides with the societal collapse. Rasputin and Cagliostro and Saint-Germain, all those biggies, Crowley, tied in very much with a whole social order falling apart, and certainly we're in the presence of a whole social order falling apart. A lack of ability to believe, and I think the Gallup poll just got through a depressing survey, and they found out that the general American public's get-up-and-go-ism is at the lowest that it's ever been since they started. The New York Times had a survey, same kind of a thing developed. So that people are looking around for the devil. I mean, and they want to get him and get him good. So I think probably that's one good reason why The Exorcist and in Rosemary's Baby and so on is going on. I think also they were whopping good entertainment, and I think people just love to be scared. Really. So there's that.
There's a more mundane explanation. The books that were mentioned had tremendous exploitation. I don't think that at this late date it does any harm to reveal what was very well known in Hollywood at the time, that when Paramount bought Rosemary's Baby from Phil Castle, who had it optioned, they sent set aside a certain sum of money. They sent it to all of their exchanges, all of their film exchanges in the major American cities, and had the employees go out and buy X number of copies of this book in hard covers, which automatically made it a bestseller, which automatically brought it to the attention of paperback houses as an important work. And this is not new, nor is this a put-down of Paramount's procedures, because this is precisely, on a smaller scale, what a certain writer named Jack London used to do about the turn of the century. He had been a hobo and an itinerant, and he happened to have friends in many, many cities. Whenever he was about to publish a book, he would send money to these friends and say, go to your bookstore and buy two copies, and lo and behold, he became a bestseller. I only mention this sort of thing because I know Harlan isn't in the room and won't try.
I remember listening to a publisher, Shelby Nayless, telling me that they had somehow or other figured out which of the bookstores the New York Times go to clear out their New York Times bestseller list, and they besieged them and bought this sort of bummer book, and they got it on. They worked.
I believe it.
And hence, yes.
This is for Mr. Wolheim. Are you going to be publishing more horror fantasy in the future for the Gallup books?
More what kind of fantasy?
Horror fantasy, weird stories.
Reprints?
Both old and new. Like, I think that you currently have an anthology that Paul Berglund has, sort of modern Cthulhu mythos stories.
Yeah, well, those are all new stories written to order. That's the Disciples of Cthulhu, which Paul Berglund, put together. We'll be doing sometime in the middle of next year. But they are all original stories written on the Cthulhu theme. There's no reprints there. I think somebody mentioned the idea of putting out a book of reprints, great classic short stories and novelettes from weird tales and things of that sort. It's an interesting experiment. I personally don't intend to try it, but somebody might.
Would you you possibly try issuing collections of short stories by, say, Robert Aikman or David Draper, maybe two well-known
writers? Well, the problem, of course, is the question of the names of people. You're up against a vast ignorance on the part of your wholesaler, your distributor, and unless they know about a dozen names in the fantasy field, and if you got somebody that they never heard of, or the specialist never heard of, you're in real trouble. You're not going to move that book. And this is true, unfortunately, of Robert Aikman, whose name is really quite unknown here. And so it becomes too much of a risk to produce it.
You saw what Mr. Phil over there, by the way, he's recording and he's holding a microphone up there. Yeah.
I've read that Motion Picture Publishers, Motion Picture Studios, will put out about 10 movies. Three or four maybe hits, and the other six may be failures. What is the ratio of hit to failure that a publishing house must have to survive any prospect?
I really don't think of it in that terms. The problem is the percentage of sale of a book hits the stands. As my wife said before, they have the obnoxious habit of ripping covers off and sending the covers back for full credit. Paperback books go out on a full return basis, except, you know, to save the cost of shipping the book back from a country which is 3,000 miles wide, they ship the cover back. And I give them full credit on that, and they sign an affidavit they have shredded the rest of the book. Which gives me a little bit of an instant. If anybody here should happen to find paperback books without covers being sold, this is an illegal and criminal operation, and to please report it to the publishers involved, because they act continuously to break this kind of racket up. They are ripping off not only the publisher, but also the authors. The question then is, what is the percentage of sale of a book? With an average title, not a bestseller, but an average good title, let us say, by a good writer and a good novel, you may still, with luck, get 60% sale, because you're going to get a certain percentage of covers torn up that never, ever got on the newsstand at all. A lot of these boxes are shipped into a wholesaler or shipped out to a retailer, and he will say, well, I've got no space in my room, and I never heard of this author, and we've got 5-15 bestsellers moving fast. Don't even open the boxes. Ship them back. And they'll ship them back and they'll rip the covers off. The books will never appear. And you get a percentage like that. There was a breakdown in Publishers Weekly of the average sales of the five major paperback houses. I think Bantam was the biggest paperback house in the business, occupying something like 16 or 17% of the market. And they had an excellent average distribution. They've got 65% of their books out, so, which means that they still got like 25 or 35% covers torn off. The company that distributes me, with whom I co-publishes New American Library, has a running average of 50%, which means that some of their worst books probably sell 30%, and some of their best books sell 80%, and it works out that way. But it is a very rough and competitive and ugly and chaotic scene. My wife before said mafia. Well, that's not fair. It isn't mafia, but these are distributors who built and fought and kicked their way up by newsstand distribution, and they still have a pretty hard-boiled attitude towards it. Another problem is that bookshops have only so many slots to put books in. And the books are being produced per month perhaps three times more than the actual slots that a bookstore has. So the life of a book, yeah, when it does get on sale, it may not be more than sometimes 3 days and sometimes 2 weeks, but a little more than that. Perhaps the saving grace is the growing creation of specialist science fiction fantasy bookshops in this country, where science fiction will have a lifetime sale of years even. They'll keep it going as long as people are interested in buying it. This is unique. This is very special. The average paperback book, if it's not a bestseller, is lucky if it's around for a week and a half.
I think that's a very good point. For those who are effective organizers and workers in this group, the specialist bookshop is a heck of a good idea. If we could somehow or other get get them located in the major cities, you could really revolutionize the this business dramatically. Yeah.
How many of those bookstores are there? Are there actually
somewhere? Well, there's one in New York, and there's
one in Cambridge,
one in Los Angeles,
one in Boston,
one in Boston,
one in Toronto.
Boulder. Is there one in Boulder?
Yeah.
One in Boulder.
Philadelphia.
As well, I guess about 12 or 15. So let's make it 30. Another figure, Dan?
The specialty stores, but aren't, you know, the rise of these specialized paperback houses, paperback stores also perform the same kind of function, like paperback stores, when they're huge, you know.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Absolutely. Yes, they are. Yes.
Well, I think that the science fiction books do stay on the stands a little bit longer because most bookstores now have a science fiction section, and I really believe that they do stay on longer.
Well, I think the point was made back there by the don't be afraid of the label as a commercial way of you put it into this box and this bin, and it says science fiction and gothic and whatnot, mystery, and they do stay there. So that's true. That's good. It's a weapon. It's a good weapon. Yeah.
How much does art undercover influence the sales? You know, now that there's better artists, sometimes a book will be republished a couple of times with a different artwork, and it seems to be you never see it, and all of a sudden you see it everywhere because of the artist. Is that true?
As an artist, I say that. I would overestimate the whole thing, so I'll pass down to a couple.
What was this question again? Oh, the influence of the art. Well, I think that essentially a paperback book has only one ad going for it, and that's its own cover. Paperback readers as a whole don't read book review sections, and they don't read book review magazines. All they see of the book is when they see it on the stand. So what that book has to sell it is its cover. Its cover is a poster. And the copy on the back, if you can get them to take the damn thing off the rack and look at the back cover, is the rest of the sales pitch. And that's it. That's all it's got going for it.
I think that in many instances, when I have fallen among thieves and listened to the conversation of editors and publishers, that about 70% of their shop talk is devoted to covers and cover artists. And as Gayon Wilson, the poor man's Richard Upton Pickman, just he modestly disclaimed that he might overestimate the influence of covers, but along with Mr. Waldheim, I would say that this is probably the most important single factor, plus the label. And I've been agitating for years to get the labels on my books changed to porno so there'd be a steady sale. In the answer to that, I thank God when something appears with a good, strong cover.
Well, I think he's two intelligent, cultured gentlemen. Absolutely right. Yes.
Yeah. And the, I don't know if it's to be adult fantasy, but there seems to be a thing where the story, like J.R.R. Tolkien's Hobbit and The Last Unicorn, the stories that were half for children and half for adults, the mixture, a blending. And now, if you write something that's half for children and half for adults, where do you send it? What do you do with it? You can't say it's for adults, you can't say it's for children, and you need it.
Of blending of things where straight fiction is dealing with science fiction, and is there a hope for that kind of story? That again gets back to the strictly marketing proposition. The answer is the kind of book you mentioned, which is half, let's say, juvenile fantasy, half adult fantasy, or half science fiction, is the publisher's horror, because he doesn't know what to label it, he doesn't know where to put it, he doesn't know how to reach the public who's going to buy it. And this is sort of in a piece of issues from actually making that sort of experiment, because it's a marketing fright. I don't know what to do with it.
Oh, a young adult science fantasy.
Young adult science fantasy, yeah. Well, I can sort of,
It seems to me that it's like in it, the actual industry is dictating the public's taste in these matters by not having a concerted program of, it seems like the money is totally evaluating the quality of the literature. Like Tolkien came out and it kind of just blew things all out of proportion. And this recent Valentine resurgence was just like a, like you say, it's an offshoot in the result of the Tolkien thing in a superficial sense. But would there be any hope for like concerted effort to get things together? Instead, it seems like it's going to end pretty soon.
Could be done pretty soon.
Well, I mean, it just seems like no more classics are coming out.
Well, I think one of the what's happened in the publishing thing generally, for sure, is that the money people are in charge, and the Quaker Oats people own the publishing houses, and it's another commodity, and they never read the darn books, and they just look at statistics, and it becomes. So there's sheer calculations having nothing to do with the writing. And as far as the so they're the organizers. I mean, they feel they've got to take the organize. And the joke, of course, is they don't, because the classics always come out of left field, usually. And there's some weirdo who's got this fantastic idea in a song, and he comes and he does it. So they can't predict that, and all of a sudden they find, there it is, so then they get a bandwagon, they try to make that another part of the calculation, so it's really kind of ridiculous and phony.
Actually, there's nothing all that unique about a few people dictating the tastes of the public. When you come right down to it, in actuality, three men control the output for 220 million people in our television networks. The three heads are the final arbiters of what goes on, and the few people, the executives under them, to whom authority has been delegated as their representatives, tell you what you will or will not see on the tube every day of your life. In motion pictures, a very few producers today, at a time of independent production, dictate what appears on the screen by virtue of one thing. They've been able to get up the money to produce a film, and they can produce exactly what they want. While they may rely on some kind of hunch or superficial marketing examination, nevertheless, it is their taste or lack of taste which determines what you're going to see. As far as books and paperbacks are concerned, I believe that fantasy is a late bloomer, and the growth popularity is always a slow phenomenon. There are very few overnight successes unless they are merchandised in a major market as such. But even Tolkien took several years really to catch on. The college campuses. I think the college campuses is where it's at today for fantasy and science fiction. In my prehistoric memories of childhood, I recall that I discovered fantasy in the only place that you could discover it in those days, a public library. I soon learned, when I got into those adult stacks, I think it was about 7 years old, I began to meet other youngsters who were into it. There was no special attempt to label, categorize fantasy for children as opposed to fantasy for adults, but after I'd read it was in the children's section, I naturally got into the adult stacks, and I made discoveries on my own. And I think all of us are more or less pioneers. Each of you have had your own special kind of introduction to fantasy, and I think that once you were hooked, if you were hooked, you began to seek it out wherever you could. You went to these secondhand bookstores in many cases, I think, to find it. You've been patronizing the dealers that offer this material. But the big problem, as Don pointed out, is that the life expectancy of the average paperback is so short, and the life expectancy of the average novel is equally short. The juveniles are constantly reprinted because the publishers realize that there is a new and growing, literally growing audience for them, which is renewed every year or so. But it is a very, very difficult thing for a fantasy to establish classical status in a short period of time.
I thought my Oyster Rolex cost more to repair than I spent for it in the first place, so I haven't got an idea what the time is. Are we, where are we as far as the... So are we at the sort of the time with the closest... okay. So is there any last flurry of... yeah.
And then I also must say with great pride that Don is his own man and nobody dictates the policy of door books. And that's the way NAL said it. They said, any way you want to come, come.
That's your good wife there, sir. Okay, well, thank you very much.